Welcome to Pomegranate Health. This is an appendix to episode 27 on managing severe asthma, containing excerpts not included in the published version. The interview features Professor Peter Gibson and Professor Vanessa McDonald of the John Hunter Hospital and the University of Newcastle. Please see the website at racp.edu.au/pomcast for more information.
That's right, it was a Lancet article that was looking specifically at the biologics treatments. And some research has shown that high blood counts of eosinophils correlate with future risk and severity, and that perhaps we should be considering preventative, you know, sort of staging model type treatments as has happened in rheumatology. Is that worth discussing, or is it a bit too far?
That's sort of where to next with these treatments. And most people, so we talked in the beginning about the current guideline paradigm is just to escalate inhaled steroid doses and until you're too scared or the patient pushes back. And we know that that's not the right approach. It's got us a long way, but it's not going to fix the problem. And so now what we've learnt in severe asthma about endotypes and going backwards into less severe disease. And you're right, identifying high blood eosinophils is a very accurate predictor of future asthma attack risk. And that's, so people are starting to consider trials in that population. Less severe disease targeted to high blood eosinophils. Well, so that would be a model of secondary prevention. Someone's got asthma and you're trying to prevent future attacks.
I guess one of the questions that clinicians have asked with that analogy you made to rheumatoid arthritis is, you know, the monoclonal antibodies are recommended for people with severe refractory asthma, and that's where, or severe allergic asthma, and that's where the evidence is. But some clinicians have questioned, well, should we kind of use the approach where we try and target things earlier to prevent the disease from becoming that severe? But there is no evidence that would kind of support that approach one way or another.
Yeah. I wanted to say something about endotypes, if we get a second. This is on the IL-5 thing. So we nearly lost mepolizumab as an effective treatment. So the phase 3 trial that was done was negative. And you have to ask yourself, what's going on here? So that's one point. And the second point is the involvement of Australian scientists in this story, which is, you can choose to cut it out or keep it in. But interleukin-5 was identified as a molecule by Colin Sanderson when he was working in the UK, but he's an Australian in Perth. Paul Foster and Ian Young at the ANU genetically knocked out IL-5 in mice and showed that you could get rid of asthma by doing that. So Australian scientists have provided this strong biology, and then the trial's done. GSK developed the drug, do the trial, and the trial's negative. And people say, what the hell's going on here? And so what was going on was that they applied the treatment unselectively. So they'll apply to all types of asthma. And it dropped blood eosinophil counts, but there weren't enough eosinophilic asthmatics to get a signal on exacerbations because about only 30 to 40% were eosinophilic. When some other investigators came back and used the sputum test to target eosinophilic asthma, and they persuaded the company to give them the drug, then they were two studies done, and they were spectacularly positive and published in the New England Journal in 2009. So that's what reignited the drug development program for mepolizumab. They then went on and did a phase 3 trial in eosinophilic asthma that was positive, and now, as of January this year, patients can get the treatment in Australia.
Vanessa, you've published some work with pregnant women, I think, or you've studied pregnant women.
That's another Vanessa. All
right. We have three Vanessas really? In our unit.
You can summarise. But there was speaking of issues of adherence, there is a fear, is that right, amongst
pregnant women about taking, so I guess.
Can you elaborate on that?
I'll hand over to Peter as well because he was involved in that work.
I'll answer that specifically. But look, two important things about pregnancy is it's predominantly mild disease, and there's appropriate concern by the mother and the doctor and the midwife about any drug use. That's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is the good news for asthma is that if you fix asthma in pregnancy, which you can do pretty easily with low dose treatment. It's an example of where phenotyping has been successfully applied to mild disease. And So what we found was that you could measure exhaled nitric oxide or pheno in the breath and use that to adjust the dose of steroid in pregnancy. If you did that, on average, women used lower daily dose of inhaled corticosteroid. They had a 30 to 40% reduction of asthma attacks, and their babies were healthier at the end of the pregnancy. So this was applying this phenotyping concept to very mild disease and getting spectacular results.
And the improved health was because of the lower doses or because of the better control of the
disease? It's because of the better control of the disease. Now, the issues, as far as we know, inhaled steroids are quite safe to use in pregnancy for asthma. It's safer to treat asthma than to leave it untreated. And one of the inhaled steroids is, in fact, category A. So budesonide is category A. Category A is the safest category of any drug in pregnancy. It's a bit like paracetamol for pain. So the studies we did use that medication. Women and their doctors, what we observe to happen is once they find out they're pregnant, women either stop their inhaled steroids or their doctors suggest that they stop it. Now, the problem with that is that if you need it, you're going to have an asthma attack. And if you do it at the beginning of pregnancy, you're doing it at the worst time because that's when all the baby's organs are being formed. So the risk is probably the greatest and the adverse outcomes are really significant. So certainly one message is don't stop your treatment just because you're pregnant. Have your asthma assessed. And if you adopt a phenotyping approach, you can actually achieve better outcomes.
So a lot of comorbidities in severe...
Comorbidity of COPD and...
That overlap, and yeah. I mean, I mentioned a number of comorbidities earlier, osteoporosis, depression, anxiety, obesity.
But in this case, with COPD, how do you... Does that help you dissect treatment in a way?
So what I was going to say was that those comorbidities are very similar to what you see in a COPD population. So in trying to differentiate between severe asthma and COPD, I think is the question, and that can be difficult. Because a lot of the features are similar for both diseases. So if you try and think of the solution to that, go back to what we talked about in terms of this precision medicine approach where we do a multidimensional assessment and characterise the individual from their traits or the characteristics that exist in that individual and then treat the disease rather than being too caught up on what the label might be.
And in terms of pharmacology, if it was just COPD, then you would just be using bronchodilators?
I think there's a proportion of people who have severe asthma but also have what's defined as COPD. And interestingly, we've done a recent study in a severe asthma population from the Omalizumab registry where we've characterised people that have had both severe asthma as well as COPD. And this was not a randomised control trial, but a registry study. And what we found was that those that had severe allergic asthma responded to omalizumab, but so did those that had severe allergic asthma with COPD. So when assessing people with COPD, I don't think you should rule out those with when assessing people with severe asthma, I don't think you should rule out people that might have coexisting COPD when you're looking at what treatment approaches they should take. And certainly with a COPD population, then your first line of treatment would be bronchodilators, and then stepping up treatment according to disease severity.
Paper inside and out. I was going to ask you about that, the asthma storm in Melbourne, but it's probably not so relevant. That's more allergic, people with mild allergic that happen to get a bigger dose of allergen, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's a great story, buddy.
It's intense, isn't it? Yeah.
There's been some publications in this, just the last edition on it.
The article I read was talking about services, like the 10,000 people attended EDs, and 500 were admitted, and 30 to intensive care. And I guess I was going to ask, was this such a freakish event that we don't need to be concerned about the limitations of services?
No, it's not. So it happens across in Eastern Australia. So we were part of investigating an episode in Tamworth, and a colleague of mine, Guy Marks, did some research and found that it was happening throughout eastern New South Wales. Nothing has been as big as Melbourne, however. That event in Melbourne, and it's happened in Melbourne many times previously as well, but nothing has been as big as that. Asthma can cause sudden epidemics, and there is a need to be prepared for the management of those. Exactly how you do it, I'm not qualified to answer, but that the articles about it, how you might go about it, refer to preparedness. The biology is fascinating. A botanist in Melbourne worked it out. He's called Bruce Knox. The pollen grain, it's rye and barley grass pollen. So you get a wet winter, massive flowering in springtime. And then particular types of, late spring thunderstorms are a feature of East Coast Australia, and the black cockatoos start flying, and that's how you know when it's going to happen. And particular thunderstorms in front of them have an updraft, and then it's like a vacuum cleaner that sucks up the pollen into the cloud. But the pollen is too big to get into the lungs. It's 30 microns, it'll only get into your nose. And what Bruce Knox discovered is if you look at a pollen grain, it's got like a little belly button up the top, and it's not made of cellulose, it's some thin membrane, and when it gets wet, the whole thing ruptures. And one pollen, which is one allergy particle, releases 600 respirable starch granules, which are a different allergen. So you get this massive inhalable dose of allergen. And so people on inhaled steroids actually were protected. So it was the people not on inhaled steroids, or that had uncontrolled asthma, or that were allergic to grass pollen but didn't have asthma. So they suddenly got a dose. So they might have had rhinitis, but then they suddenly got a dose that could get into their lower airways, and then they got these asthma attacks.
And a different allergen, but close enough.
Yeah, LOL P9 is what's on the. So it's in the same family, but it's subtly measurably different, and that's how you could work out that it's not that something different was going on.
And perhaps if you're going to have 10,000 people with respiratory distress, you want to have every primary care clinic competent to
that's right, to manage acute. But it could happen with anything else, like it could happen with a massive air pollution accident, a massive dust accident. You know, we're full of potential risks around the place, power plants, coal this and coal that.
As a nurse, Vanessa, do you think there could be more upskilling of primary care staff and nursing staff to deal with severe attacks or episodes?
Yeah, well, definitely. I think, you know, of people's primary place of presentation, well, it's not necessarily primary place of presentation during exacerbations, but often they present to their GP during periods of acute unwellness. And primary care nurses are in an excellent position to not only kind of, you know, work with the patient during that event, but also work with the patient to avoid future events. So there are a lot of education strategies available for primary care nurses, or when I say a lot, there are strategies available for primary care nurses in asthma management. But I guess, like the general practitioner, there's a lot of things that come into the surgery, and ensuring the expertise in all of those things can be challenging.
Well, what would you, for someone who's never had asthma before and suddenly they're having an attack, what would you for
giving bronchodilators to start with? So I guess, you know, for someone that's never had asthma and then suddenly has that attack that you speak of, like the National Asthma Campaign has a four-step program for managing acute asthma, and that involves giving Ventolin 4 puffs every 4 minutes and seeking help immediately. So that's a good message for the public to be aware of, I think.
Well, let's now talk about the latest, greatest. So the first biologic treatment made available for asthma was omalizumab. They're great names.
Yeah. So do you want to know the code?
Yeah.
Okay, so you start from the back and move forward. You can apply this for every
drug?
Every monoclonal. So you talk to someone about cancer or rheumatoid. So MAB. Monoclonal antibody.
Oh, right, of course.
The second last syllable tells you the species or where it comes from.
Lizard.
So zoo mab. Zoo means humanized monoclonal. So they might have made it in a mouse, but 99% of it. There's another one that says GXI means chimeric. Human mouse chimeric. And then the third last syllable tells you the target. So lizumab. So li means lymphocyte. So, but there's another one for osteoporosis. It's something os, something mab. So os is bone. So that's the code. And then the rest is fluff.
And what about the cadence of it? How do you know
So the again, it's the last bit, zizumab,
omalizumab.
So
you say in the paper that a limitation of this therapy is the narrow therapeutic window.